Grab your beverages and turn up your interweb. Solving the world's problems 12 ounces at a time. It's Dudes and Beer.
Everybody, and welcome to the Dudes and Beer podcast, episode 196, coming at you live from the home studio here in Austin, Texas. Tonight, we have, of course, Stephen Bishop here with me.
Yo, what's up, listeners?
Oh, back up just a little bit. You don't have to swallow things now. Yeah, yeah.
Where's my headphone?
It's there. It's all good. Wouldn't have changed the fact that it happened. just letting you know. And also with us this evening is Billy Joe Kane, as well as Chris Kavanaugh. Chris Kavanaugh is the executive director of the Radical Empathy Education Foundation. And, of course, Billy Joe Kane, our regular guest, Dudes and Beer technology correspondent, as well as founder of the Radical Empathy Education Foundation. How are you guys doing?
Oh, man, this is great. I'm doing fantastic, and I've got so many good things to say. It's very exciting, and thank you for having us on.
Well, absolutely. Well, say them. Say these exciting things.
You're jumping off your chair over there.
I know. I'm trying not to wiggle too much. I got my hands actually under my feet so I don't bounce against the table. So there's a number of things that have been happening lately, and I'm really excited about it. We have – not only are we in – sorry, let me tell you what we do. Radical Empathy Education Foundation is a nonprofit – that it's a 501c3, was set up so we can actually teach kids and young adults how to avoid human trafficking. And we're using my background in interactives, since I've been doing this for about 25 years. And the idea was I wanted to create something that would really connect with kids, get them to understand this from a perspective that is totally different. So we're using virtual reality simulation to put people in the shoes of a victim, so that victim can actually explain how this happened to them. It works inside of virtual reality. And so that's like our first phase of a three-phase educational process. The second phase is we use educational materials that are traditional classroom stuff that teachers can implement in the classroom. And the third phase is what we call a Change Makers Project, where we get kids, students, anyone that's really been interested in this to make a difference in their community. So that whole process of figuring out what it is that we should be is something I feel very good about now. It's taken us quite a while to not just iterate on the VR experience, but also to iterate on our product delivery. We are currently in a school here in Austin called McCallum High School, and we are starting on the 25th of January with a school in San Diego, and I really can't be excited enough about it. We also had just gotten invited to go to the state capitol and demonstrate in a private room for state legislators on January 22nd. And all that information will be up on our website, radicalempathyfoundation.org, or you can get there easily by typing in reefcares.org.
Yeah. And, you know, you guys, I've had y'all on for, didn't seem like it's been like 2 years almost now. It's pretty wild. Yep. It was right after Classic Game Fest a couple years ago. You came in. It was Steve-O's birthday. He actually tried one of the first versions of Trapped, a VR detective story, which is, of course, the VR game developed by Radical Empathy Education Foundation.
That was a cool episode.
And to see where you guys have come to now – I'd like to hear from Chris for a few minutes. How did you come to be involved in this project? How did you come into the fold with Reef?
Yeah, so I was working at a local mental health nonprofit here in Austin called the Austin Clubhouse. Billy and his wife Jackie volunteer there pretty regularly, so I got to meet them through that, and he just told me about his project, and I started off just helping him with some of the early stage nonprofit formation stuff, like incorporating, getting all the nonprofit paperwork filed, and just gradually kind of got to know him and really believed in what he was doing. And about a year and a half ago, came on with him full time. So, yeah.
And Chris is kind of brushing over the fact that it is incredibly difficult to get all that paperwork done. So cheers to getting that done.
Yeah.
Oh man, getting nonprofit status was
it's not
insane.
Easy. It's yeah. not no. easy.
IRS is not fun to deal with, believe it or not.
IRS.
Well, and you know, with all that paperwork filed, with everything done, what was it that began the mission of? Because there's one thing to, of course, the game. That's just one level of what Reef does. And I want to talk a little bit more about what Reef does and the mission and the reason for using VR before we start really kind of rabbit holing, as we do, the world of VR and VR development.
Well, let me give you a little bit more about my background. I've been in interactive for a long time, and I basically was serving sort of as a contractor. So people would come to me with a problem or a project, and I would have to find a way to solve it. And virtual reality was something that I had not used a long, long time ago, but this whole new round of having decent hardware and things that are relatively inexpensive has become something you can do. And what I learned about it was that virtual reality can make you feel. And most of the experiences that I tried early on were basically like scary experiences, and they weren't really trying to work on anything like empathy or caring or connection or things like that. But as I started digging into the research, it turns out that that is one of the things that virtual reality is extremely good at. It blocks you off. You're just in a space. And if you can create a scenario that makes you care about something, the studies, and I mean everybody from Stanford, just dozens and dozens of universities, show that it not only makes boring material interesting, it makes the experience more fun. It creates what they call active learners. So when somebody is finished with an experience, they'll actually go figure or be interested in it themselves and go learn more. It makes people more confident in what it is that they learn. It's also what they call experiential education, which let's say it engages multiple learning modalities, whether mm-hmm. it's your visual, your audio, your mm-hmm. aural, or your motion, which is like physical.
Mm-hmm.
So interacting or having as many of those senses engaged at a time puts you into a place where you may be able to reach flow and be more less concerned with the world around you, and you actually can experience that. And so what happened for me was, once I learned that that was possible, it really kind of what's the best way to say it? It made me realize that there was a social problem out there mm-hmm. that I had learned about.
And then you can start seeing it around you right in your everyday
life. Well, exactly. And I found out, I had an experience where a friend of mine was actually, turns out that he was a sex predator, and he had started talking to my kids. And that, along with my interactive experience and virtual reality, all kind of formed this little, I don't know, it coalesced into this thing I wanted to make, because none of my friends knew anything about it. None of the kids I knew anything about it. My kids didn't know about it, and I didn't know hardly anything about grooming and normalization of sexuality, normalization of aberrant behaviors, if you will. And so I wanted to build something that would help.
Right.
And the first thing I did, and as I was explaining earlier, I've gone through a journey of this product to create something that I think would really have some educational power. I started off thinking I'd build this and I'd give it away for free. And it turns out that, and I was going to do it on cardboard, which is your phone. And that really wasn't getting picked up. And so my programmer wanted to do a version on the HTC Vive, which is like super hardcore. So she started building that, and that's kind of where I was like, oh my gosh, this can really, really make a difference. And as Chris was saying, we've gone through these number of iterations. Then we thought about, you know, using this in schools, and that means we had to create an educational curriculum. And then as we did that educational curriculum, we realized we needed the what's next, and the what's next is the Changemaker project. We've iterated on our VR product probably 8 different times, taking it to a conference, looking at how people use it, you know, finding out that we were wrong, reiterating, going back and finding out we were wrong again, and over until we finally have a product now where just about anybody can put the headset on, experience it, have it affect them in an emotional way. And when they're finished, they do a lot of self-reflection. We've had people tell us that things they've never told anybody before. They've taken the headset off. And one gentleman told us that he was molested by his uncle at age 12. And he took the headset off, told us that. And the next thing he said was, I've never told that to anyone before.
Wow.
And he's like, I got to go deal with it. We've had a parent whose daughter was hanging out with new people, sneaking out of her house. And she's like, you know,
yeah.
I said, that's what's in our experience. She's like, well, that's not going to happen to my daughter. So it probably won't. She went through the experience. And when she was done, she was crying uncontrollably. And she came back to us. She walked away and she came back and she said, I have to get my family in therapy. I have to really, you know, start a different relationship with my daughter.
Yeah.
And I was like, this is some powerful stuff. And even if our product doesn't make it to anybody else, I know that we've made a difference in the universe. And that was really my entire point.
Well, and I think that's just it. I mean, someone the other day was asking me, what's the use of bringing this kind of VR into a school? And I was like, you know, as someone who taught, I can definitely see where especially if you get a technology forward school, a school that still has some sort of like after school coding program,
yep.
even programs like Girls Who Code, mm-hmm. Stuff like that, probably a great one for y'all to try to team up with.
Right.
And even produce some kind of, open source VR that can then be like, you know, kind of changed by the kids in the after school program where it can teach them in a modality that they need to learn.
I can't believe if I haven't told you this yet.
It's interesting.
So at McCallum, we're in their VR club. And in their VR club, they have programmers and they have artists. They have all sorts of people that put together projects and they all work inside of Unity, which is our project.
We are allowed to say the name of the school now, right?
Oh, yeah, McCallum.
Okay,
yeah.
Okay. McCallum, everybody. McCallum. Because I know at one point the principal didn't want me
emailing everybody in the universe.
Yeah. And fully understood, you know, there are things to be worried about.
Right.
There are children involved.
It's, well, the thing that's really interesting about McCallum in particular, and I'm sorry. I'm sorry if I'm spreading the word too much about McCallum,
but
they have a fantastic tech group, a fantastic VR group.
Yeah.
And what they're actually doing right now is I've given them the code, I've given them the art and the audio, and they're working on building an Oculus Go version, and they're knocking all the polygons down and the models. Yeah.
That's really nice.
I've given them everything so they can do exactly what you're saying.
Yeah.
And of course the deal that I have with them is that all of the students should be able to use this in their portfolio forever. And I'll tell you, I've worked with the universities. I helped start the Austin Community College game program. And one of the things that has been true for every game design program I've seen across the nation, and I haven't seen everything, but the ones that I've seen, no one gets a finished project from a real developer that they can tear apart and do something else with. It just doesn't happen. And right. I think it has to do a lot with IP.
The only way that happens, it's absolutely an IP issue. It's an intellectual property for those of you just tuning into the Dudes and Beer podcast. We just did an episode not too long ago with Raul Diego, who's going to be coming on fairly soon with part four of his Borderline documentary. Yeah, and part three was actually talking about how, like, most of the drug war as we know it now started due to a law that was passed in, like, the mid-70s, early 70s, that literally made intellectual property part of national security, under the blanket of national security.
What? I've got one for you. He should look into this too. I read a book a long time that was about the Mitchell brothers, and they had this basically a strip club in California, and they also did pornography. And what was happening?
Enterprising lads.
I know this is weird because my topic is sex trafficking and human trafficking, but
there is a total difference between that and sex workers and people who are in the sex trade legally.
I have no problem with people that are sex workers. I don't know if Radical Empathy and our board of directors are on the same page as me, but here's the thing.
Yeah.
You're a human being. That's your body. Do what you want with it.
Yeah, that's your choice.
If you're too young and you haven't figured your stuff out, or if you're obviously under a certain age, absolutely bad. Anyway, so let me roll back to the story of the Mitchell brothers. They were making films, and their films are being copied. Of course, these are like 35mm things.
Yeah.
And the problem was that they were not being protected. So those guys went and they took it all the way to the top. because they're like intellectual property.
Oh, and it needs to be protected. Documentary maybe.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so they are the reason that when you watch a movie, it says FBI warning.
Yeah, that's right.
It's like that. So essentially porn provided intellectual property protection for movies.
Yeah.
Wow.
It's also the whole reason that VHS became the mode of the day.
That's a fact.
As opposed to Betamax.
Betamax was owned by Sony, and Sony wanted to approve all the titles, and because nobody had to approve VHS because it was an open format.
Wow. Yeah.
That's why everything went to the cruddier format.
Yeah.
Well, it was essentially open source hardware.
Right. Right. Yeah.
And
yeah,
we've seen that a couple of times, even in the game industry. 3DO did it, a few other systems. Yeah.
I'm here to tell you, folks, so forward-looking was beta.
It's very interesting.
That
beta was amazing.
Even to this day, beta is still used at numerous television stations. It is a standard whenever you make a commercial. Many stations still ask for a digi beta now, but it's still beta. It's still the same format, but it's digital.
Yep.
Because those Sony blacks, nothing gets blacker, like no light escapes it. It's actually patented. And that's one of those things that was part of the intellectual copyright that led to that split. There was none of that on VHS, which is why if you pop in one company's VHS as opposed to another, the black will look gray at the beginning, and the other one, the black looks kind of reddish. You know, they're all different shades, but none of them are like vapid black with nothing else, because that's Sony. That is the intellectual property of Sony, that color black.
That guy that bought the rights to the blackest black of all time.
Yeah.
So that guy actually purchased it.
How can you own rights to a color, though?
Well, it's not a color technically.
Oh, it's
a blend of all colors.
Oh.
Or actually subtraction of all colors. White is the blend of all colors.
Right.
But
it's anyway, yeah.
Because he actually patented a material that was the blackest substance other than a black hole, is what's claimed. And like they did all kinds of measurements.
On a mission.
It's like going into a soundproof room where it's so silent you can hear.
It's crazy.
You're blood going through.
I knew video guys that were there, and they were like, it was eerie to look at. Just to look at it. They were like, it looked like he was in a Looney Tunes cartoon.
Yeah,
he was holding up this fabric.
Yeah.
And it was literally a circle of the fabric, but it looked like he was just holding a three-dimensional hole.
See, that's what's
like he could have just reached in and grabbed something and pulled it out.
When they reissue Spinal Tap's album, it should be covered in that material. It's like a black mirror.
It's like a black mirror.
None more black.
A lot of that, talking about the intellectual property, talking about the way that you open the code up to the kids and let them do that. It's an amazing, beautiful thing.
Well, I think that, you know, when you provide this stuff to kids, when you get we basically give them the hardware, they get the software, they get the educational materials, they can keep them forever. We support people till the end of the school year, but they can use this stuff forever. And when you get to the what's next about this thing, well, one of those what's next can be, hey, this is a technology, this is a tool, this is hardware that you can use in anything that you want to, whether you want to put them in Google Earth or let them, you know, experiment with this stuff. But, I mean, how cool would it be if I have a school that wants to translate this into Spanish or German or French, and they can just do that and provide us that data, and all of a sudden, hey, look, it works.
Man.
And it just – so the power of doing these things is open source. You know, it's good for the kids.
Yeah.
It's good for other kids. You know, it could help them get into a college. You know, if you have somebody that's really into recording, they've got their home studio. They can do this. Translation is an entire industry.
It definitely brings about the whole concept of skill set. And the fact of – you can learn to program Python at home with a $39 Arduino machine.
That's right.
Yet still, whenever I go to every single major like high tech conference that I work on supercomputing, and I've got a panel of people before me from like the dude that created Watson for IBM.
Oh yeah.
You know, and deep learning machines to somebody who like helps build their pipeline. Everybody says if you're going to go to college right now for coding, learn Python. learn this, because there is always going to be terminal jobs. But if you want to make yourself indispensable, make yourself able to control what that controls.
You brought up Watson, and we work with a software engineer slash leader slash all sorts of things, and he was actually the guy that worked at IBM, and he did all social and gaming connections with Watson.
Wow.
If we get enough funding and income, we can actually build an experience in virtual reality where you can speak directly to a victim and they will talk to you as if they are alive. So it's like there are so many things we can do, and I have the technology, I have the leads, I have all the connections. Mm-hmm. We just need funding. If we have that funding, which we're trying to do, this as a business. So we go to a school, we provide them the hardware, give them the tools, they use it forever. They can even use the open source stuff if they have a technology group, which we hope to do with the school in California. But if we have the ability financially to continue this, not only do I want to tell more stories, not only do I want to give more education, I want to do things that are so far outside the box that people can't even imagine it. I mean, can you imagine being a victim on a plane and the stewardess walks by you and you're like, you want to tell them, but you can't because your captor is sitting right next to you.
Yeah.
And there's so many stories and experiences I want to tell. And this stuff can be used for trauma-informed social workers, right? So right now, police don't know anything about this, but if a policeman can have a virtual intake exam with a victim, that would be amazing. I mean, how often do you get a chance to talk to a real victim? Or what would it be like to be the victim talking to a police person and have that person ask you all these really pointed questions? You would feel how that experience affects you, so that it would make you change the way you think about your job. And all of this stuff, and if you build it correctly, it's just like having a role-playing situation with someone that's a super expert, and it can be taken everywhere. This isn't like in big cities. I'm talking about small cities that don't understand this kind of stuff, and you would give these people the training that they couldn't get.
It can be done from your mobile device.
Well, yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
It could.
Like
if there's an internet connection, we can connect you to a vast neural network that will speak to you in any language and teach you anything. Well, I mean, it is, isn't it?
Yeah.
Watson is nothing but a giant neural network that's absorbed so much information and can spew it all back to you in your language. It's crazy.
Yeah, and we've gotten to the point now, especially with AI, where in the last year we had the first computer actively pass a Turing test.
Oh, jeez.
Blind, not knowing what's on the other side of a wall, responding to them. A human being was asking questions and getting responses from a computer and utterly thought that they were talking to a human being.
Yep.
That's how fast the response was, how organic the response was.
Well, you're talking
everything
about
else.
You're talking about all this new technology that you're
Well,
going to
you
be
started
going
bringing
to.
Up neural nets connecting people. And
well, we know
you
that
know,
the next or the first real iteration of quantum computing is coming. It's
already here.
Well, here's what I would say. Yes, it's here. However, it's going to be the thing that basically breaks the internet. There's no such thing as security when you have something that can absolutely break everything.
Right.
So it's like when quantum computing goes outside of the research room and becomes viable for spying, you know, it's going to be weaponized.
Let's just use the analogy of Job. And once it gets out of the server that it's on, once it's outside of that critical loop of my computer's talking to your computer, talking to your computer, talking to your computer, and our computer makes up the mass computer.
Yep.
Once it's outside of that loop, it's a totally different
situation.
Sounds
like the main nervous system for like Skynet, you know, the main backbone.
You know,
it depends on what it decides to optimize itself for.
Yes and no. you know, it's interesting because I, of course, work like the NVIDIA chip conference, things like that every year. It's
right.
Pretty awesome.
You see what's at least a year out, at least.
To minimum.
And it's coming, dude.
I was there when they were announcing the the upcoming human versus drone league.
Oh my gosh.
Where it will literally be teams of human flown drones versus teams of autonomous drones.
Well, you've seen the numbers. I mean, computers can outfly any human being, period.
We now have, according to Defense One, which is pretty much the white paper of the Pentagon, it's like they're, it would be like they're like, biz rag, you know, like the, like if you lived in LA, like, oh, what's going on in the scene? Let's pick up Hollywood today, like the Hollywood Report.
The Austin Chronicle for you know? Defense.
It's like the Austin Chronicle for defense.
Right. The Village Voice.
If it's happening in the Pentagon or within the defense sectors, you will hear from it from Defense One.
Maybe it's the exact opposite of the Village Voice.
I think so. But they announced all of like 3 months ago that we now have a full telepathic control of drones.
Why wouldn't we?
Yeah.
Why wouldn't we? If we can, let's do it. Why not? What could go wrong?
Well, we've had, of course, the Alpha Wave games for years.
Oh, yeah.
You know, the Jedi mind trainers, mm-hmm. stuff like that, where you basically train your brain to create alpha waves.
Right.
In different stages make you create different waves, and that's what makes the ball levitate.
You know, I think we might have talked about this before, but one of the – I mean, sort of bringing this back just a tiny bit to VR. I mean, of course, you know, you can fly drones through VR as
All day long, yeah. And that's how they do it.
They've actually used VR to help people that are, let's just say they have spinal injuries. Mm. They show them their legs moving in virtual reality. Mm. They're like, if you think about it, it moves. Right. And it actually will make them be able to move their real body parts again.
Yeah.
Now, of course, it depends on the injury, obviously, but that does work. So it's like there's some seriously powerful stuff that, you know, your mind, if it's not uptight, so to speak, can actually, you know, make those connections work again. It's crazy how smart our brain is and how much we underestimate it, so to speak.
Well,
but it's not gonna beat a computer flown drone, is it?
No, no. And, you know, if we ever, and that's what I was going to say, is, you know, of course, the guys I work with and have up on my stage are always bringing up things like, oh, well, you know, I doubt that we'll have a Skynet type scenario, people. The chances of us having like robotic overlords, you know, that kind of thing, AI that goes that far, are pretty few and far between because we cannot program in emotion.
Well, that's an interesting concept.
So until we learn to one and zero emotion, till we learn, like, we can one and zero a polygon, we can one and zero perhaps even a smell, because we can at least compare it to a known chemical compound.
I got one for you. So there was I wish I could remember any of the details about this, but how anybody else could search for it. But they set a program to try to find the fastest way to pass electrical signals. And so they were like, what's the fastest path through this silicon, so to speak, to be able to make something work? And it came up with a way that was faster than anybody could have ever expected. Really? And they didn't know why it was working. And it turned out that two of the wires inside the silicon were close enough that they could actually pass a signal through the air.
Yeah, they could air gap it.
Yes. And the system figured out how to do that on its own.
On its own.
So these are the things that, you know, I know that we really don't perceive or expect, you know, it to be able to build more robots, so to speak.
Right.
But if you give it a command, will figure out how to do it.
I fully expect the fact that it will be able to build more robots.
That's what they're...
We've already got that.
Yeah, I was going to say that's kind of
what I'm saying is I think mankind
already got robots building Roombas.
Let's hope, but I mean,
they're wanting to conquer space with kind of do stuff like that.
What I'm saying is, man becoming an unimportant part of the equation.
It's coming. The question is when.
Now, the bigger thing that I've heard, especially, and this wasn't even futurist. This was straight up like chip engineers. And people that like use these things to process mass amounts of data. And to hear them say that Moore's law is almost moot.
Yeah.
that we've literally gotten to a point now. Moore's Law
is computers get twice as fast every, what is it?
Six to seven months.
Right.
Right, yeah.
Yeah, the basically what it is mathematically the number of transistors that can be put onto the surface, mm-hmm. onto a micron surface of a chip, mm-hmm. doubles.
On that die.
Which right. means that speed and processing power technically doubles. So mm-hmm. metrically, you're talking about quantum
computing is going to freak
crazy stuff.
So that, yeah, the question is, I wonder if it's not just that, but it's also the amount of throughput or the number of calculations that something can do. So it's like, I don't know how much of that is that, but I don't know what quantum computing is going to do. I don't have any numbers on that as far as how does that jack Moore's law up on like a total vertical? Who knows? I don't know. That's something I haven't done any research.
Well, and that's what they were saying is that we know that this is possible.
Yeah.
We know it's going to happen. It's not even a question of if it's possible mm-hmm. or if it might happen. It's the fact of get ready. It will be broken. No longer be applicable to what we're talking about and how we're talking about it. It will be a point of fact that within the next couple years.
Wow, the next couple years.
Granted, that's the fact that the technology exists. Will you be able to go onto Amazon and buy it?
That's going to be a while.
Probably not. That's going to be quite a while.
Ship to my door in an hour, dude.
Eventually,
they already have that,
bro. Well, it's quantum, so it may just be able to jump to your door.
Yeah.
Jump right? to my door. It's going to skateboard over
yeah.
you.
But there's one of my friends had done a bunch of studying looking at the adoption rates of new technology, right? And so it was like they looked at radio, television, computing, internet, et cetera. And it turns out there's like basically a 15-year curve. It takes about 15 years before something becomes ubiquitous and everybody's got it. The beginning, you got the early adopters.
Yeah.
So, you know, what's that going to do with quantum computing? Who knows? I mean, that probably will be a pretty good curve, but even at the very beginning, it's going to change the way that we look at everything. Ooh. I mean, you know, right now the way that the internet works is like you have a number that says I got to get over to the other number. So you have the number that says this packet belongs to this other number. Well, quantum computing can basically just totally dissect all those numbers immediately. So there's no such thing as security unless you are running a quantum computer that can create some type of security cryptography that will run at the speed of a quantum computer. I don't know how that's going to work.
Yeah.
I don't have any idea, but those are the things that I've picked up so far.
Those are the principles of quantum computing, yes.
Yeah.
And, you know, when you're talking about that application with virtual reality.
Right.
Before we started this show, you actually started talking about some of the new applications for VR that the military mm-hmm. is looking at.
Right.
And actively investing in, not just looking at, actively putting money into.
Mm-hmm.
And you said that one of them was training soldiers via VR to spray paint airplanes.
Right.
To spray paint fighter jets.
And, you know, when I first read that, I'm like, well, duh. But it's like that seems like such a simple thing to teach somebody. But it turns out that with the amount of hazardous materials, the breathers they have to wear, everything else, it's like it's really expensive to train those soldiers to actually do that on a plane, whether it's like, you know, ensuring that they're spraying properly, getting around all the corners, et cetera. but they're willing to pay for that because the cost of doing it in VR is drastically cheaper than someone making a mistake when they're really doing it or inhaling all the vapors and everything that they may get while they're trying to train doing that stuff. So, I mean, it definitely saves money. And, you know, they find those type of applications for everything. But the question I have, obviously, with, you know, being a concerned citizen is if we know they're painting things, what else are they doing inside of virtual reality?
Yeah, you know exactly. What
I'm saying? You know, the military has been using virtual reality. And if you dig into it, I'm like, we're talking back to the 40s.
Oh, yeah.
You know, with these. Yeah. And that's only what I've heard and what I've been able to research on the internet. So it's like, you know, I mean, even a flight simulator is virtual reality.
Yeah.
To some point, you know, it just depends on, you know, how immersed you are. And does the immersion mean that you're in a cockpit and then you see the screens? Well, depending on how you look at it, yes, that's still virtual reality.
Pretending it's
real. Oh, and there's one point that I want to make very clear. virtual reality and 360 video are different things. 360 totally video is things. Not virtual reality.
No.
But when you read the papers and when you read all the hype that's out there, if you dig deep enough, you'll find out that many of these studios, many of these marketing groups, and many people that are providers call their product virtual reality when it's just a movie. And don't get me wrong, it's cool to watch a movie in VR, but it's still a linear, non-directed, non-interactive narrative that's controlled by somebody else. Virtual yeah. reality is a computer-generated situation that you control the narrative, you decide where to go, and you can interact with different things in a way that's totally different than a movie, which it's
yeah.
it's a significant break, but you're still told and fed that this is a virtual reality experience, but it's not.
Yeah.
That irritates me. And honestly, it's I think it diminishes the amount of work that's required to build a real virtual reality experience versus I put a 360 camera in a location, hit go, and then it records it, and then I just play it back whenever I want to. That's
yeah,
just,
well,
that's
and
linear.
And let's get into that somewhat because sure. because yeah, a very important thing is that distinction.
Mm-hmm.
It is that interactive distinction, not right. just the interaction of turning your head and the perspective moves,
right.
But there's depth. There is being able to physically interact with objects, right. things
and
like that.
Just for the listeners, imagine that we're really talking about painting a plane. So what you're saying about the depth, for example, mm-hmm. when you're looking at a lot of VR experiences, you're generally just moving a mouse around versus getting close to a plane where you have to push your hand out in a Z axis, let's just call it. So you're pushing yeah. into it, and if that paint isn't applying to that plane, you're not close enough.
Right. Yeah.
And you develop
that
and you develop that muscle memory, and you connect it with your head and your eyes and where your memory is going. And so you're basically teaching them everything versus watching a movie, for example, of someone painting.
I can
a plane.
Totally
but
see
I
that
just wanted to kind of make that
yeah.
kind of work for a listener. A lot of people I talk to don't get, so to speak, in air right. quotes, you know, virtual reality.
Yeah. Well, and that's why I was saying it's a huge distinction to make.
Really
because
is.
you really do have to make that distinction, and the fact that VR is by definition it's not augmented reality.
Correct.
It's not like we were saying interactive cameras.
Yep.
It's literally a reality that responds to you.
Mm-hmm. Right. And another good example of let's say 360 VR is like if you see some of these house, you know, walkthroughs on mm-hmm. computers.
Oh,
like
yeah.
You move from one little ball, so to speak, to the next. And when you're in that ball, you can look around, right? Well, it's fantastic. It's a great technology, but it's not virtual reality.
No.
Now, VR would be you build the house in 3D and then you walk through that house
yeah.
and you can move anywhere you want.
Yeah,
and it's maybe. And this may be another way to look at it is it's generally in stereo. So it looks 3D to your mind because there's two cameras and they're just at the same distance as your pupils are. And then it allows you to see things in 3D just like you do with your real mind versus a movie, which is still 2D.
Yeah. Mm.
So, oh, and as you mentioned augmented reality, which may also deserve its own, you know, definition, so to speak. So like people
oh, absolutely.
Have seen Pokemon Go still has users like 5 million a day.
Yep.
I looked it up.
Wow.
And what it does is it allows you to use your phone and augmented reality,
yeah.
you know, Jigglypuff will appear on your desk.
Yeah.
And what that means is you still see reality, but that 3D model is there in front of you. And it's obviously not there, but it looks like it's there. And
yeah.
that's getting better and better and better.
Fine, Jigglypuff.
Yeah.
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 Exactly. You go there anyway. But yeah, so and another way to look at augmented reality is thinking about the headgear that a pilot would be using.
Yep.
It puts the little target up in front of you, the little numbers and things like that. And that's not in front of you. It's projected by...
Yeah, that's a heads-up display.
Yeah.
It's
and if people are
projected
doing it on their cars,
by...
so they see the speed limit on the window because it's
yep.
bounced, that's augmented. Because your
yep.
reality is augmented by some other type of device
right.
or computer-generated thingamabob.
Yeah.
So anyway, so for users, VR is 3D, it's in stereo, generated by computers, 360 video is generated by a camera. It's non-stereo. 2D. It's 2D essentially, but you can look around. And then the augmented reality is something that is pasted, so to speak, onto your reality. Yeah. A hologram could be considered augmented reality, of course. At least that's the way I see it.
Yeah. And, you know, what I find amazingly awesome is being able to, like you were saying, remove pilots from a physical cockpit and put them into the realm of going to other planets, put them into the realm of traveling to the moon, things like that. Being able to train people for long-term missions, that kind of stuff.
We have I've had the chance to meet a gentleman named Skip Rizzo, and he works out of USC. I hope I remember that right. But he works out of a college, university, and he's actually created experiences that you can use while you're swimming. So he has like a waterproof VR headset. And
oh, wow.
It feels like there's dolphins around you and stuff like that. So you can imagine if you're going to be an astronaut, they can put you in a zero gravity environment inside of a pool, as they always do. Right. And you would actually look like or feel like you're in space, and you would feel like you were in space.
Whoa. Yeah. Wow.
Yeah, I mean, just use your imagination, right? Yeah. It's like, imagine that that's actually happening to you, and you can visualize that.
Wow.
And you don't think that you're in a pool, because you are in space from what you see and you hear and all that good stuff. So it totally would simulate that. Wow. And why wouldn't they already be using that?
Right.
If they're not, call me. My number is briefcares.org.
Yes.
You can find the contact info. I will help you make a space simulator.
Dude, that would be awesome.
Just like Wing Commander.
Yeah. Just like Wing Commander. People I worked on a space sim. Heck yeah, I forgot about that. Yes,
now,
absolutely.
Chris, since you've been involved with Radical Empathy Education Foundation, since you've been involved with this world of VR, what have you seen not only change with the technology that y'all are incorporating, but how has your view of this technology changed?
I think the biggest change is, you know, we started off on the Google Cardboard, the cell phone version, and just seeing it kind of evolve to the Vive now, and all the machine learning stuff that we're talking about implementing is just insane. But I think kind of from a non-tech person's kind of perspective, you mentioned at the very beginning, people ask you questions like, why do we need to bring virtual reality into a classroom like this? Well, you know, look at the target audience we're going after is middle schoolers and high schoolers who are attached to their cell phone. And there actually is, you know, some good training out there right now. There's, you know, tons of smaller nonprofits all over the country that have made curriculums and some that actually have it in schools. But the biggest difference, you know, for me is it's all on PowerPoint or taught by their, you know, in-class teacher. Every now and again, it might be something on the computer, but it's like those, it's like those classes you take online when you get a ticket, the driving classes.
Couple of videos, some interactive quizzes. And,
But, you know, when you say,
Chris has actually seen the kids run across the conferences too.
Yeah, that conference we were up in Fort Worth, you know, there was 100 booths of different teaching people trying to sell textbooks or all different didactic things. Huh. And we were the only VR there, and we had, you know, the longest line of the whole place.
Oh, yeah.
Because, you know, when you put tell kids, hey, we're going to learn about human trafficking today. I'm going to put you through a 100-slide PowerPoint and the lights are going to be off. You know, they're going to fall asleep. Whereas, hey, you know, everybody gets to come and do this 5-10-minute virtual reality experience where you get to meet a girl that's just like you. You know, she met her boyfriend online. She gets to high school.
Yeah.
And to feel, you know, that connection, empathy with them, and then learn the materials, you know, the warning signs that they should be watching out for, that kind of thing is just wildly more effective. So that's, you know, the coolest thing about it to me.
That is.
It's amazing watching people have that awakening, so to speak, and that connection. In fact, one of the things that we've learned, I mean, we've, you know, Chris and I have been around the entire United States, New York, California, Portland, everywhere. And one of the things that we've learned after speaking to a lot of, I guess, professionals and experts in this field is that so many parents have no idea how this is possible. They're like, how is it that someone would start, you know, having sex for money? And men in particular, fathers, have no concept of how that could happen. My daughter, my son, that would never happen to them. And when they go through our experience, they walk away knowing that this is psychological manipulation. This is Stockholm syndrome. Yeah. And when they when they do that, it's like it changes their whole perspective of how dangerous the world can be for kids and how little that their children know and how they are supposed to be the ones that provide a safe haven and the correct information at the right time for these kids. So, you know, it's the entire thing from watching the kids run across the room. Mm-hmm. We make sure their parents are there. The parents can watch what their kids are learning. But when the parents go through this experience, it's it's significant.
Yeah.
And VR is the only thing that can do that.
Yeah.
As far as I can tell.
Aside from experiencing it, being there, short of that.
You have a very informed, best-in-class teacher walking you through this experience, and you just can't get that any other way.
Yeah. And our listener, Dean, actually chimed in with, hopefully quantum computing does more for us than having smartphones did. rather than taking advantage of unified knowledge, we watch cat videos and creep on our friends rather than hanging out. And it's absolutely true.
Right on.
And that's something that whenever you're like, a parent is literally like, how could this happen? There is no way that could happen to my daughter. There is no way. How is it that somebody is willing to take money for sexual favors?
Well, you can talk to them until they're blue. You're blue in the face.
Right. Yeah.
But when you put them in that in that space, in that headspace, in that mind.
You definitely have to look at the fact of, like you were saying earlier, with the person that you knew that began to, and I'm going to use the term, normalize.
That's exactly
your
right.
children. And whether it's normalizing them to a mentality, normalizing them to a form of media, or normalizing them to, like you were saying, physical or aberrant physical affection or behavior.
Right.
Which when we say that, folks, we aren't saying that like I'm 44, Billy's up around my age,
I'm 51,
my age.
Baby.
Yeah. You know, so
I'm every bit of 50.
Our version of aberrant physical behavior is a little bit different. We are consenting adults. When you're talking about a 12, 13, 14, even 16, 17-year-old kid, do they really have the capacity to realize the long-term implications? Do they really have the capacity to be able to rationalize the long-term implication of even putting a photo up online?
Right. You know, that's a really great point. All of those things are. So I didn't know what the word grooming meant. And basically it is. It's normalization of aberrant behavior. And that can be it can be sexualized behavior. It can be drug use. It can be stripping. It can be all these things. And when people do that, they generally will say things like, this is our secret. You know, there's a number of stages that people go through. But this normalization of that basically turns into thinking that that is the way that everybody thinks about things. And this normalization could already have happened inside of your family.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, you can have, you know, sexual abuse or mental abuse or physical abuse that happens inside of a home. Mm-hmm. And then you just think it's normal. I mean, my father was an alcoholic and he came home yelling some days and normal some days and sad some days and all these different things.
It's normal for everyone, right?
For me, the normal thing was you would just roll a die and figure out who your dad was going to be that day. And that type of randomization was normal for me. And so now, I mean, things like a door, you know, rattling too hard or somebody yelling triggers me.
Right.
And I'm very aware of that. But that was my normal. When I went to see other friends, I go spend the night at other friends' houses. I had friends whose family sat and talked. And I was like, what is this?
What's that? You know,
that was normal for them. But for me, I was like, that was way out there, and you can imagine this happening. Yeah, I mean, how do you get past that?
Right.
I mean, and that's just yelling that it was a trigger for me.
People don't realize exactly like how far down the rabbit hole of society this normalization and grooming goes.
You mentioned photos.
It goes all the way down to the, and like I said, I will not say I have not looked at online pornography. I'm not going to say I haven't looked at pornography. I won't say I haven't looked at pornography. I'll say it three times in a row.
I mean, I think this dude looks at pornography.
At least
he won't say.
We know.
But I'll never say it.
Well, I mean, right now you've got 10-year-old kids that are watching, less than 10-year-old kids, and they watch it on their phone.
Yeah.
And it is normal for them.
And that's just it.
That normalization.
That normalization of activity.
Long term.
That is, now I would challenge anybody in this room, and we got four people of ranging age within about 15 years.
There's close to 200
raise
years
your
of
hand,
experience.
Yeah. Raise your hand if any of if you clicked, let's just say 10 average videos that you have randomly run across on the internet, gentlemen.
Yeah, right.
let's take a quick poll as to what the normalcy of those videos are. Is that like a 10% normal for you? Any of those videos that you see on the internet? Is that a 10% normalcy bias for you?
I'll open up and tell you that when I was a kid, we would go out into the field and there was like a treehouse, and inside that treehouse were some nudie mags.
Right. Sure.
And
that's old school.
And that's where, that's where normalization of that type of behavior for me began. Right.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not an 8-year-old kid addicted to porn.
That's what you have to consider, though, is our form of normalcy at the time was very much perhaps you might find an 8mm if you knew how to spool up a projector.
Right.
You might find a VHS. More than likely, you found somebody's dad's magazine.
Yeah. Oh, it's, and all of those things.
The likelihood of that being.
I mean, some of my friends' parents had stacks of Playboys.
The likelihood of that being anything aside from an exposed female form, perhaps in an extraordinarily body position, is far, far different than the normalcy of what goes on the internet nowadays.
Right.
I've started.
And as I said, nobody raised their hand as to whether or not that was any video that you saw on the internet.
You that
was
nobody
a 10% normal.
Any of that question. Yeah. And in fact, I even changed the topic to
it. Because it's not a normal. It's not even a 10% normal. Not even one out of every 10 times that you get together with someone of the opposite or same sex will something like what on the internet happens. So that's like trying to believe Cosmo, boys and girls.
Exactly.
You know, it's not a point of reality. Yet our normalization bias
teaches
us that it is.
My kids, I don't think they'll kill me for this one, but I mean, I let them know that when not if they see pornography.
Yeah.
I was like, when you see it on the internet, it's very much built just like an action movie.
Right.
I'm like, dude, when you watch Die Hard and you see somebody shoot a car with one bullet and the car blows up three stories tall, it's like,
that works.
That's not real.
Right,
and that's
right.
What I've explained is like pornography is not real love.
Nah.
It's not. You need to, that's in my opinion, works. You need to understand that that's not reality.
Well, and of course that's creating a balanced human being within rearing a child and
they're
teaching
gonna
them,
see it.
Right.
Teaching them the difference between sex and sexuality.
Or love and sex.
Love
or,
and sex.
Or sex with love. I mean, these are significant concepts.
Right.
Or even
society,
sex within the bounds of reality.
True.
Because
reality right now with our children is that they are going to see this, and as parents and as adults, we have to understand that, and we have to talk to them about this stuff.
Yeah.
This is very real. And of course, you know, pornography, a certain percentage of that, or even let's call it a large percentage of it, could have problems with human trafficking. Let's not lie to ourselves.
Yeah.
It's possible. And of course, watching pornography and the quantity of pornography that's out there definitely leads to more people having these problems. And in fact, one of the people that I talked to up in Portland, they introduced me to this new term, which was, to me, it was new, called the illusion of choice, which means that we, as consumers of any product, we have decided that those people chose to do that for themselves. And I think that was a significant
time.
But for me, just that term, illusion of choice, really framed how I need to think about any particular thing. And it's like, did that person really choose to do that job? Yeah. Did they really choose to do that? I want to convince myself that they did. Did they or not? And of course, there are people that choose this, and it's okay for them to choose this. But it's something that you can't just blanket say that everybody chose to do that. Right. It's an interesting twist, and it's something that you need to teach children.
Yeah.
You can't avoid it. This is a topic, no matter how uptight you are as a parent, you have to talk to your children about. Your children are going to be out of your sight at some point.
Yep.
And they are going to experience some of the deepest, darkest, ugly that the universe can provide them. And if they are unprepared and they don't know what normal is, they are going to fall into that rabbit hole. You have to assume they're going to.
They get exposed more earlier these days, with technology.
Exactly. I mean,
it would screw up the minds of kids that are just still like growing. It's like,
I have been very fortunate to start working with a gentleman that does, he works with adolescents and he teaches them substance abuse, let's say therapy, so that they can actually stop abusing substances. And one of the things he's starting to see is pornography addiction.
Yeah.
And by the way, one of the things that I've been picking up is that pornography addiction can actually lead to erectile dysfunction and other significant physical and mental issues later in life. And it's something that a lot of people don't think about. Basically, you kind of, I don't want to say normalize this behavior, but you've ingested so much of it that it changes the way that you see the world.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. It alters the filter of what you believe is reality.
Exactly.
And that's why I was trying to give that 10% example, because of every video you see, like not even 1 out of 10 of those would be a realistic situation, would be none of that. None of that.
It is all illusion. I used to ask my kids what they saw on the way to school and the way from school. This is before they really got it. And they would just start telling me about, beer ads with beautiful people that looked like they were having sex, and a vodka ad where a woman, obviously with red lips, is sucking on a cherry while it drips juice down her face. And you're like going, this is what my children are getting when I drive down the road.
Yeah.
Talk about normalization of over-sexuality. Right. I mean, it's happening on television, but this is, you can't stop your kids from looking out a window. You just can't. And so you are essentially part of that normalization unless you talk to your children about that. Like, that is not okay. That is not okay. And how many times are they going to see that? I mean, it's all about impressions and eyeballs.
They have a question when you say it's not okay. Well, then why is it everywhere kind of
that, girl? Like, because I was talking to them, they kind of got it. In fact, there was one place where I would pull out of their school and I'd go down this road to get out to 35 faster. And there's a sign advertising for a strip club. And it says, "Our girls wear nothing but a smile."
Yeah.
And you're like, what is that teaching my children? I'm not an uptight parent. But you cannot avoid this stuff.
Right.
Yeah. Talk to your children.
Right.
Yeah.
Talk to them.
And that's just it. Like, VR is some great stuff.
Yep.
It's amazing technology. And to know that we are on this cusp, not just as a people, as humanity, but as a society.
Right.
And as a human society, not just the American society.
It's everywhere.
I'm a robot, dude.
To see how this technology, saying, is coming to light. Even in the Big Lebowski.
Chris's favorite movie.
Jackie Treehorn was talking about virtual porn, dude. It's the wave of the future.
Did you ever see Brainstorm?
That was about 20 years ago. Oh, God, yes.
Brainstorm.
I love that movie.
I've had one of his favorites.
Brainstorm was movie. Where,
great
for
soundtrack.
Those of you that are younger than 51 years old, may not have heard about this movie, but it was a way that someone would record their emotions.
Yep.
And the way that they visualized that in the movie was essentially a VR 360 movie. So and those people would be experiencing it. And so they had like everybody lined up at a boardroom, and they were all experiencing being on a roller coaster at the same time. And they're all moving to the left and moving to the right and everything. But what happened was this one guy basically found the porn that was after the roller coaster, because some, you know, researcher, you know, was having sex with his, you know, partner. And this one guy wound up stuck at his house in a loop. That's all he did. He quit eating, he quit drinking, and essentially it killed him.
Yeah.
So these are things that it's not a concept. Sorry, that this, this is not a new concept that this can actually seriously, you know, affect humanity.
Well, yeah. And I mean, I remember, I remember that movie so well. The soundtrack rocked. And it was not an extraordinarily well-made movie, but it had some really, really deep concepts when it came to this.
Very forward thinking.
It was all of a year or so, after Lawnmower Man came out. And it was really one of the first movies to tackle some of the ethical quandaries of VR.
Right.
What could we do as far as recording people's experiences? Mm-hmm. What could we do as far as changing the way that people filter reality with VR technology? Mm. And like you were saying, there's that 15-year curve. We're right up against that right now between Lawnmower Man and that. We're right at that 20-25-year curve of that.
VR and AR is starting to really make it now.
Yeah, it's gone beyond the adoption of the technology and really to the point of where are we going next with this technology? It's already been implemented. It's already been put into place.
Yeah, I was looking at some numbers today kind of to prep for this, and they say that there are – somebody's going to call my BS on this, but I think there's like 100 million people that are using AR and VR on a regular basis now, and they expect it to obviously grow. I mean, people are still playing it, but the point is that it's become normal.
Right.
It's becoming more normal. And, you know, we're going to expect more marketing materials that are doing this. We'll start to expect more, more every type of material that's out there. It's happening. And when it can happen on your phone, that's exactly why it's going to be so widespread and just continue to be. You were asking, one of the things I think you had put in the show notes was about what's going to happen when, you know, AR is like ubiquitous, when you're wearing AR glasses, essentially, and your real world experiences is augmented for everything. I saw a movie, a short actually, that described, or didn't describe, it showed that everybody was in a grocery store had AR glasses on, and everything that you saw was like, you know, you need to drink this milk was this awesome thing, and it had videos that popped up and people talking to you full on Blade Runner style. And then her glasses glitched, and she's basically in a Kroger in 1984, essentially. I mean, like, we're looking at a really crummy store.
Yeah.
When you have the glasses on, it looks like you're in Vegas and you're pulling the thing, and you won.
Yeah.
Ding, 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 ding.
Yeah,
I think, but you're buying the same product, right?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
I can totally see that coming.
We're already seeing products that have what they call a marker on them. So it's like you look at that and a marker will happen. Well, now you're seeing things like with, you know, Apple's, AR kit, where it actually can notice and find surfaces and shapes and items. So you don't have to look at a little target that's on the ground. It actually can put something on the table. With shading and lighting being appropriate, it's out of control. So the reality, so to speak, of augmented reality is becoming more and more realistic.
Yeah.
So, you know, when you see like a Pokemon right now, the Pokemon isn't shaded correctly.
Right.
But eventually they're going to get to the point where not only can it actually sit on the table, it can walk off the table. The lighting will look perfect. Oh, it'll be almost exactly like you see Buzz Lightyear
right
in front of you, and he can hang on the edge of a table. He can jump up. There'll be a shadow on things. It's coming, dude.
Whoa.
It's getting there.
That's deep.
Yeah,
it is. And there'll be some point at which you really can't tell the difference.
Yep.
And it's not far away.
Ooh.
Wow. Not far away.
Yeah, we're getting to the point now that we have contact lenses for this kind of stuff. We have integrated wearable technology.
Transhumanism, as we've discussed before.
Oh, yeah.
Here it comes.
It's on the way.
Yeah.
I mean, there's more than one company, I think, that have patented the AR and VR contact lenses.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So it's on the way. And the people are already working on it. I mean, you've got Magic Leap that have had a number of crazy, like, holographic patents and insanity that they've been working on. They've got tons of money. And I don't know all of the things about their technology, and I don't know all of the things about where they're going, but what they have and combining with ARKit and combining with the other technology and the better computing and better cell phones that can do this stuff, it's coming, dude. Coming.
You think there's going to be any health issues with stuff like that?
That is a great question. Like I was saying earlier, the military has done a lot of studying on this and a lot of research. Mm-hmm. And the few people that I've talked to about this in the military, they say, look, 15, 20 minutes, that's all you should really do because it might mess you up. And that's military style stuff. And we have people that are staying inside of VR for hours. So our experience that we designed for kids and students and young adults is 15 to 20 minutes long, depending on the depth that they have. And that's by design. We did not make this thing so you could stay in it for 2 hours. So if anybody ever asks, why is this thing so short? It's short because of safety reasons.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. Well, and you know, that's something that we brought up on the show numerous times, just with screen flicker rates, things like that. Like, you know, you're looking at something flashing four times faster than what your eye can physically see.
Yeah.
But yet still receiving it in the brain.
And
well, you're hacking your brain.
Yeah,
the brain basically thinks it's real.
Right.
You've got micro millimeter, you know, correct positioning that matches the stuff that's in your ear. You've got this thing that's running faster than your eyes can see.
Right.
You know, it's hyper real. There are ethical, you know, concerns that we need to take into account. I mean, we had one guy one time, he took the headset off and he goes, I don't like this map. You know, it's like he goes, as soon as I took it off, I'm back to all my problems in the real world.
That's kind of almost how I felt when I first used it that one time.
Right. And if you think about that, if you have a personality type or you are prone to addiction, if you will, you know, these are the things that's an ethical question. Do you really want to create an experience that is so engrossing that someone would rather do that than involve themselves in the real world?
Yeah.
You know, the gentleman that was writing to us.
Yeah, Dean.
I mean, it's a potentially major problem. We have to make sure that we consider all these things as we move forward. And as you know, we have humans that are already being edited with CRISPR in other countries.
Yep.
You've got embryos that are being grown.
We have scientists editing people with CRISPR, or at least claiming to, that are disappearing.
Ooh, time to take a drink for that one, because that's some messed up stuff. But it's happening in the ethics.
Absolutely.
As we know, that scientific ethics and military ethics and even just regular people that are building things, nobody's checking on this. Nobody is deciding this is good or bad.
I mean, just kind of there right now.
The only normalization is what can we do, not what should we do.
The problem is, and that's something that we talk about all the time, is that caveat, that eternal caveat of the fact of just as fast as Moore's law moves, our ethical law does not move so fast.
Oh, not just our
the moral imperative.
Thing. Oh, and our
does not
law
move so fast.
Nothing keeps up with technology. It seems
it literally cannot keep up. They have no idea right now.
Morals,
like, as far as self-driving cars, they really, like, insurance companies. I work there. Conferences too, they are really wondering what the hell to do about that. Much less if you're like chilling out barbecuing in your backyard and a drone falls on your head. How are you supposed to cover that? Well, I mean, like I don't see a State Farm commercial for that one yet. Do they cover that?
No.
Do they
Captain
cover
Chaos
drones
or whatever? His
do they? Name do they? You know, like do they cover drones falling out of the sky on your head?
I mean, beyond the physical
That's
aspects
an act of, God.
Of it, as far as well, yeah, an act of propeller. I mean,
yeah,
what do you call it? But
yeah.
I mean, there's the ethical problem of I've been watching that show called The Good Place, and they have this one show that's about this ethical problem. It's the trolley problem. Which is like you go, the trolley goes one way, it kills one person, go the other way, it kills a bunch of people. Which decision you make, that has to be programmed into the AI of a vehicle. It has to decide a young woman pressing, pushing a, you know, a baby in a carriage versus
to respond to that and make that.
Yeah, decision. I mean, it's like full on Death Race
single,
2000.
Single
but
mom
you're
pushing a baby in a carriage or an 8-year-old kid walking. The car next to me is going to die.
Right, and so the question is, okay, first off, who programmed that? Just in general, but somebody's going to die, and then who gets busted for that?
Is anybody
that
but me,
or the programmer, or the group of anybody but me.
Anybody but me on both
and
cases.
Then like, what, and
the
then
dying
what
and the blame.
And then okay, so let's say yeah,
it's
and so let's
the
say it was the yeah, so let's say it was the AI that made that decision. Okay, well. What if it was a person making that decision?
So
how would you sue somebody for that? And how do you sue? You know what I mean? I mean, there's so many ethical questions that either haven't come up yet, you know, or they have and nobody has actually really made a point of it. But it's going to happen if it hasn't already.
It's in the midst of
it's
happening. We've already had it happen.
Right. But the courts probably don't have a law yet.
We have nothing yet.
Right. And so it's like murder is murder or, you know, unintentional manslaughter is still, you know, an accident. But it's like sometime the law will catch up and it's going to be like what mad scientists made that decision and what morality did they decide that upon? Was it, you know, who knows?
Yeah.
Somebody has to make that decision, you know, or maybe it's random, you know, and is random a problem? You know, so many questions.
Yeah. And that's just it. When it comes to the efficacy and the efficacy of this technology, what it's being used for, why it's being used, if we should adopt it for certain purposes, it is something that I think rightfully, like you're saying, Billy, we have to take in great stride. We have to really, really stop and think about this and not so much make it a knee-jerk afterthought.
So, I agree. I mean, it's almost like
not
you know,
too many people are stopping to think. It seems like they just keep creating, keep progressing further with technology, but not stepping back to think first, you know?
Oh, man, they're growing embryos right now.
Right, exactly.
They're growing placentas, actually.
Actually, we just
am I wrong about that, or is there more?
No, no, no. We actively just had the first baby born from a placenta transplanted from a dead person.
Whoa.
Right. And where's the morality there? I mean, I don't know. It seems like a good idea to save, you know, the baby or the fetus or whatever you prefer at whatever time.
Oh, no. This person was not pregnant at the time of death.
Wait a minute.
They literally the other person had a non-viable placenta. Not placenta, because of course the placenta is formed around the baby.
True.
Non-viable womb.
Right.
So they transplanted a womb from a deceased person into her, and she was able to get pregnant, conceive the child, carry the child to term, and just had the child. First in medical history.
I mean, you know, on the one hand, on the one hand, it's a beautiful thing.
Right, right.
And on the other hand,
what could happen from that?
And on the other hand, talking about ethical transplants, we just had the person getting ready to go through the first full head transplant.
Well, I've seen the face transplant. Yeah, but
we've had
thing.
Numerous successful face transplant, but there was one person specifically that was going to be going through a full head transplant.
Yeah.
And just fell in love and canceled his transplant. So there are the two different sides.
And then there's other
questions. Of your ethical quandary
right
there. There's one person giving birth from organ from a dead person and another person saying, I would like to continue my life in a different way, but I'm willing to not do that in order to continue life in this way to be with this person.
The questions are boundless.
So, yeah.
Right.
They're boundless.
And as we kind of wrap this episode real quick, Chris, where do you see things going for the future of VR as you see it and in your application of things?
Yeah, I think the education aspect of it, really. Actually, I see a lot of real good potential applications in healthcare, particularly mental health care. You know, I mentioned that I worked at a mental health nonprofit mm-hmm. for 5 years, and they're already doing a lot of advances with things that psychiatrists can do, talking to you through virtual reality. So I think the kind of way it takes over your emotions, such as empathy or bad ones, you know, that you need clinical help with, that there's a lot that can be done there. So,
okay.
I mean, we've seen PTSD treatments. We've seen
fear aversions, like walking up to the edge of a cliff and not being scared. In virtual reality can help you with things like that. So,
yep. If you're afraid of spiders or, you know, there's a number of, I've seen some military applications in that they not only are putting people through, I guess you'd call it aversion therapy, but, this is called Strive VR. If you want to look this up, I was put together by that guy I'd mentioned earlier, Skip Rizzo. And they put people in the military through incredibly stressful situations. And in the VR experience, right after it happens, a virtual mentor walks out and says, you've just experienced something that's traumatic. You need to make sure that your brain is working. Your brain is also a weapon and part of the thing that you have to use to keep yourself, you know, safe. And so the guy tries to tell you, here are some breathing exercises. Wow. Here's why you need to go see an actual therapist. And I got to tell you, I went through one of those experiences and I started using those breathing exercises because there was some really traumatic stuff. You're in a regular everyday situation, so to speak, as far as a military person, you're kind of just checking on an area. The guy kicks a soccer ball down an alleyway that they were supposed to walk down. The kid gets blown up and it's like, oh my gosh, I wasn't expecting that. And then the sergeant walks out of the smoke and says, here are some things you can do. It's incredibly immersive. And as Chris was saying, this type of experience can lead you to figuring out how you need to live the rest of your life and what type of self-care that you can do. And this works for anybody that has any type of mental illness. You can find out what your triggers are, and you can find out what cures are. And again, it goes back to, do you have an expert in your area?
Yeah.
We are living in Austin where there are these type of treatments, but you know, if you're in Dime Box, Texas or Nowhereville, Kansas, those experts don't exist. But if you have access to this stuff through the computer, through VR, any way at all, you're dealing with experts that are world class, that are research backed, and that type of therapy experience, trigger reduction, etc. Those are the type of things, and you know how to deal with your triggers. Those type of things that can really change people's lives.
Yeah, absolutely.
And hopefully save their lives and their families' lives. And, you know, there's right. so many things that happens to our veterans in particular, not to mention everybody else that has their own type of mental illness.
Yeah. And thank you guys so much for coming on, Billy. I'm always, always happy whenever you show up in my studio.
Thank you so much.
We always have some great conversations. We need to make it more regular than like every 4 months.
Well, when I
want to say
town,
it was 4 or 5 months.
I was going to say, Chris, you got to stay in town.
Well, I got to physically be here.
Look at who is where. Well, I mean, I think we do. What is it somebody says? It's like when our meat sacks or our IRL can be in the same location or biosphere, whatever the hell you call yourself. But it's like as long as we can be there. Yeah, let's do this as often as you want.
Absolutely. And Chris, Thank you so much for joining us this evening. Yeah, Steve, pleasure. Great seeing you tonight, as always. Let everybody know where they can go to check out the work of the Radical Empathy Education Foundation, Billy. So
the easiest way to find us is reefcares.org or .com or on Instagram or on Twitter or anywhere.
Hashtag ReefCares.
Hashtag ReefCares, at ReefCares. We are all over that. Our regular webpage is RadicalEmpathyFoundation.org, but that's really way too long, so I've got to redirect to that.
Nice. And while you're online checking out all the great work of the Radical Empathy Education Foundation, Billy Joe Kane and Chris Kavanaugh, and all the other great folks there, please do make sure to stop on by the Dudes and Beer podcast. Dudesandbeer.com is where you can check us out. That's where you can find the everything. Everything, all our episodes. That's where you can find all of the news, news of the week, the knowledge vault.
Oh, yeah.
All kinds of great stuff on the Dudes and Beer website.
As well as
HC Universal Network. Stop on by and check out the HC Universal Network of podcasts, as well as all of our great stuff there, from shows like Talking Sound Podcast, Gray Matters Radio, Yes But Why Podcast, Scary Dad, all kinds of great stuff on there. Thank you so much once again, guys, for joining us. Thank you so much, everybody, for tuning in. And until next time, everybody, remember, if you can't be good, be good at it. We'll talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
Bye, guys.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Dudes and Beer Podcast. To listen to our audio streams or chat with us live, download the official Dudes and Beer app for Android and iDevices, available on Google Play and iTunes markets. For more episodes, content, and information, visit us online at dudesandbeer.com. You can also find our episodes on Breach.tv, iHeartRadio, Spreaker, SoundCloud, iTunes, YouTube, Stitcher, or your favorite podcast service. Dudes and Beer is a proud member of the HC Universal Network family of podcasts. For more about our sponsors and other podcasts on this network, visit hcuniversalnetwork.com. Thanks for listening, everybody, and until next time, drink responsibly.